This reading is from Richard Rose's Psychology of the Observer. This is on the frontispiece. In the robot, the designer placed a little curiosity to keep the robot moving once it was assembled and born, so that the designer would not have to perform every motion for every robot. But the robot became curious about his origin, and immediately the designer became a direction of the curiosity. In the robot, the designer placed an ability to recreate, so that that which was created creates not only by reproducing, but also by projecting mental creations. And all of this was designed to transform the robot into a self-sustaining unit. And thereupon, the original creation, with its orderly intentions, was placed in jeopardy, and the robot forgot his curiosity about his designer and projected phantoms of false hope and monsters of desire, and darkness was projected as light. Psychological directions. Psychology, as we know it in this century, is the observation of the behavior and responses of man. It would like to be a science, but in its analysis it ignores some of the factors. It is in itself not pure, but is part business and part politics. It is not rooted upon the firm earth of materialistic proof, and yet it hovers close to that earth, afraid to explore the higher or more subjective fields of inquiry. It hangs in midair like a space platform, massive as to its paradigm, but very weak as to direction and substance. Such a psychology is only pretensively scientific. I have elsewhere made the remark that the pursuit of psychology along behaviorist lines is similar to that of a geologist taking soil samples in order to determine the essence at the core of the earth. Most modern psychology, as taught in universities, does no more than try to anticipate herd desires or instincts. Man is being treated as though he should not act like an individual, but he may well be one, and his essence, his purpose, and his mind can be better known by looking into that most individualized function, which is thought. The psychological writers sensed that they were doing this, skirting the fringe, or else they would not have redefined psychology away from its meaning of science of the psyche to an interpretation emphasizing the mind as being somatic and one that responds to mechanical or material tests. They hold the conviction that materialistic and tangible proofs will appear, or at least there will appear laws that will bear formula similar to the formula in the material sciences. Psychologists' only claim to scientific grandeur is its feeble effort to be predictable. It pricks the surface of the body, predicts to some degree of accuracy how most people will react, but that is how most people's bodies will react. If you plant a certain seed in the soil, you can anticipate a standard reaction. But this tells us nothing about the center of the earth or the ultimate destiny of this planet. Likewise, reflexes tell us little about the psyche of man or about his source, intended purpose, and all of the unknown factors that work toward those designs. Current psychology is nothing more than a paradigm. A few people, such as Kuhn and Chilton Peirce, have made note of this. Quite a few psychologists, beginning with Jung, have admitted that the behavior of the mind can at all be discovered, cataloged, and categorized by studying the body alone. And it will take years of effort to repair the damage done by the behaviorist and get back to the study of thought instead of reflexes. We must ignore professional survival. We criticize the witch doctor for spreading an unproven dogma for the purpose of arousing faith in his medicine, and we revert to the same primitive sin. We must not get into ecumenical reciprocity with the other witch doctors, mutual back-scratching, that is, with special allowances for union brothers. Everyone is not correct just because they went through the apprenticeship and are steady dues-payers. Unless modern psychological trends are reversed, psychology and psychiatry will not only be useless, they will become diseases. The pose of possessing expertise in interpreting and controlling behavior is a fraudulent pose for the sake of funding and acceptance as a social regulator. They will only contribute to the increasing sickness of society. The Skinnerian approach is one of oversimplification. The sins of the behaviorist are legion. They pick out only that which they wish to see and label the prescription of anyone outside their guild as being bad medicine. Regardless of the efforts by many behaviorists to skirt the vast unknown psychological territory, which should be familiar territory to them, they can never escape the constant challenge to their inadequate understanding of the mind, and by mind I do not mean the somatic mind alone. There are many phenomena of a mental nature that they blithely brush aside because there is no explanation for those phenomena within the limited domain of their paradigm. What do they have to say about ESP, established cases of telepathy, psychokinetic performances, materializations, or deja vu experiences, not to mention many other phenomena which seem to infer we have a mind element beyond the reflex system and the brain? While some psychologists admit the phenomena as being valid experience, many deny their authenticity, and some go as far to attack the sincerity of those who testify or submit to scrutiny. To the combative behaviorist, telepathy may be the reading of facial muscles or plain connivance by the two parties involved. Psychokinetic demonstrations and materializations come under the heading of simple fraud and manipulation, and deja vu experiences to them are really cases where something happens to a person and later that person's imagined that he had a prior dream or a hunch that it was going to happen. The behaviorist is inclined to remind us that his province is that of mental illness, which to him is synonymous with physical illness because he treats it with physical drugs. He brags that he has a drug for every complaint, yet privately he must realize he is curing nothing. He is removing the symptoms only. So will a tourniquet around the neck or a sledgehammer. There seems to be no concern for the long-range effects of drugs. The concern is for society, and the patient must be converted to something congruous to the current social passions. The behaviorist hides behind a facade of objectivity and practicality. That which he does not see does not exist. Certain factors in behavior are beyond his comprehension, so they are labeled as being subjective. Of course, subjective things do not exist. Morality is a subjective matter, and virtue has become an odious disease. To the behaviorist, love is subjective, but a valid observer noted that a baby monkey's and human babies often died when deprived of affection or something to which they could affectionately relate. So the paradigm rejects the word love and replaces it with the word stroke. They admit that people need to be stroked, and the depths and nuances associated with the word stroked may be deeper than we suppose at first glance into this protoplasmic therapy for plastic humans. According to the modern behaviorist, morality is subjective, being an idea that must be sacrificed for the peace of the herd. Rape can be abolished by training children to submit. With this frontal assault upon morality by the brain trust, we wonder about their private thoughts about religion, which they are not strong enough to attack as yet. Behaviorism is a disease. The subtle symptoms in the beginning stages are the processes of creation of new definitions for old words with a tacit demand that we drop words from our dictionaries that do not conform to their paradigm. The layman, and all are laymen when it comes to psychology, has no other means of defining terms than the dictionary. No study is doing more to confuse the basic system of human understanding than psychology. The words objective and subjective should be avoided whenever possible. There are so many definitions for the two that they approach being synonyms rather than antonyms in a few cases. Each author has to designate that which he means by his use of the word. The object of our study in psychology may be subjective determinations, so we then have an objective, which is subjective. As a definition for object, we find in Webster existing only in relation to a knowing subject. It appears that any subjective matter, once it is found to be scrutinizable, is immediately objective. The word normal is another. In psychological use, it generally is intended to mean average or average behavior as determined by a normal curve. End quote. However, there is another definition, and that is sane. The average reader is acquainted with the sanity connotation, but the student of psychology will be influenced by the knowledge of the process of finding averages by using the normal curve and may forget that typical does not mean sane, being subliminally influenced by the word normal to automatically interpret all such findings as infallible indications of sanity. It was quite typical of many races to eat human flesh. Instances of such cannibalism are not considered sane by us, nor was it considered sane by us, our forefathers, when it must surely have been considered sane and proper by those who were cannibals. If we accept as being sane that which is occurring now or within a particular society, then we are certainly not being scientific or searching for a true answer. That which is typical is ever changing over the years. Sanity should be a constant which is not encouraged by whim, collective caprice, or the typical. A science should have a defined language, and it should begin with a point of reference. Chemistry has to do with material analysis, so its point of reference is the atomic table. Physics has to do with the substance of matter, with the properties and mechanics of forms of matter, so its scope includes the atomic tables, but also any and all systems of measurement of matter. The point of reference for physics is matter and energy and their measurements. The point of inquiry for psychology is the mind. There are two possible points of reference. For non-conspiratorial psychology, it is the knowledge of the mind from a mental viewpoint, which I admit is a next to impossible objective. For the behaviorist, the point of reference is the body. In neither school are these bases or points of reference properly defined. Most books of psychology are commentaries which carefully neglect to tie their feelings or findings to an established foundation of psychological knowledge, perhaps because there is no foundation or real agreement as to terms. However, some awesome terms are thrown out for the benefit of the customers. We have not yet distinguished whether schizophrenia is a disease of the brain, one of the toenails, or is some degree of possession. Paranoia is normal. All animals and humans have it, and it had better have it in order to survive. Yet the behaviorist argues that we do not have these fears every hour and every day of our lives, so paranoia is the exception rather than the rule, and they want it included in the abnormal category of attitudes. Is the policy of the behaviorist largely to ignore that which they do not see? In dealing with thoughts, they bring all study of thought to an abrupt halt by ignoring the total subjective process and admitting as evidence only things which in reality may only be the result of thought, namely reflexes. They do not wish to properly analyze this thing called seeing. Who is seeing, and what is the quality of this seeing? Can we gather dependable scientific evidence as a result of this seeing? What sees? Modern psychology leaves a large gap in the very beginning of its paradigm structure. I think that there is a pretense that we should all understand that we are the body. I do not agree that I am only a body, so I require a definition in greater depth. I am convinced that there is more than that which is seen. Viruses are not seen, yet we admit to their presence. But the doctor tells us that we admit to the existence of viruses by their effects. By the same token, can we not admit to thoughts as being something more than reflexes by virtue of their effects, such as psychokinetic events? The basic words or tools of psychology are undefined. What is thought? What is sanity? Is it something else than the rate of incidence as indicated by the so-called normal curve? It is becoming increasingly evident that man is not a body alone. We are more than that which we see. In the study of the physical self, one of the first things that we learn is that our senses are inadequate. This dimension is not properly viewed by us, so that if there are any other dimensions or planes of experience, their intangibility makes them more inaccessible and immeasurable. But this does not justify our pretense that they do not exist. There is a mountain of evidence available that would endorse for us the premise that man is more of a reactor than a doer. If we look at our daily actions, we see them to be the results of previous actions or of reactions by us to events or stimuli from the environment. And such reactions in themselves appear to be programmed. But it never occurs to most of us to ask who is being programmed. Nor do we seem perturbed to note that we fail to deny that we are all automata, even though each of us feels profoundly separate and unique from our fellow man, so that we view ourselves with the full force of intuition and conviction as being something beyond the body and despite the reflexive limitations. I maintain that it is equally valid to presume that we are never that which is seen. If we refer to the group of cell colonies that make up the body and wish to define ourselves as being only a physical body, we immediately wind up with little to stand on, and little that is definite as far as the definition goes. Life is apt to prove that our definition rapidly diminishes to zero as the body ages and vanishes. The hand, which we think is an integral part of us and a very evidential part of this materialistic self, can be lost, and we would then presume that part of our self is forever gone. The legs can be amputated and we are still self-aware. Kidneys and heart can be replaced and life goes on, as well as consciousness. The brain is manifestly not expendable, but some who survive severe cerebral injuries and unconsciousness attest that they maintain a condition of awareness in regard to their environment. And strangely enough, many cases where severe cerebral impairment has occurred manifest an awareness of another dimension. In other words, we have testimony from people who were pronounced clinically dead to the effect that they were aware of other planes and dimensions, as well as the people in or from this dimension. See Moody's Life After Life. Truly, if we are that which sees, it is not the hands, legs, heart, kidneys, flesh, intestines, eyeballs, ears, or any specific master switch in the brain. We are not that which is seen. We are basically the observer. In matters of self-observation, the view must never be construed as the viewer. When a fellow insists that he be identified as that which we see, he is correct in as far as we are concerned, he is only a view. But from his point or true perspective, it is doubtful if he accepts himself as being merely that which I see. Even the psychologist who bravely defines himself in these terms does not really believe that he is a robot. If he did, he would be compelled to lose interest in the game of life and in his role as a helpless pawn. We say repeatedly that the body is all we have, and by saying this we imply that something has the body. We also imply that this body constitutes our only contact with reality, and we see reality from that body and through that body. So that in relation to the reality that is witnessed by our body, the body is very real and may be the only self we will know with the mundane viewing apparatus. It is only when we become aware of another dimension that we are able to give a just evaluation of this dimension from a detached point of observation. This is where all psychologists miss the point in the business of evaluating the mind. Even if they admit that there is a separateness or entity called mind, their view of that mind is with the mind. Through many ages, only the mystic was able to come up with the answer as to the real nature of the mind. We might even say that the untutored LSD addict may have a clearer view of the nature of the mind, which we ordinarily believe or accept as being our thinking process, because he gets a glimpse from beyond our conventional thinking process and limited sensory input. Candy cannot be described in terms of candy. All definition requires a description or reference to things that a thing is not. The mind must be viewed from outside the mind. Delusion. At this point, it appears that we have given up on studying the mind, and that I am conceding with the materialistic approach is the only correct one, and that we have come full circle back to the original point of error and futility. Our science cannot help but start with a materialistic or radical discipline. However, if it is truly objective, we will discover little agreement with the behaviorists in the long run, and our realizations will inevitably become subjective. To explain this, I feel we should be methodical in our approach and not rely on wishful thinking as regards our real nature. If we begin our examination of the self without preconceptions, we will be less likely to produce or discover only an echo to our desires. On the other hand, I believe, because of my own personal experience, that such an orderly and scientific approach to self-observation will nevertheless lead to subjective realizations that truly will be extraneous to and ulterior to that which we would now call our somatic or mundane mind. In any laboratory of chemistry or physics, the analysis is not much better than the precision of the measuring instruments. In the business of analyzing ourselves, our findings will be conditioned to the accuracy of our tools, which are our senses. So the self-analyst must run a check on his senses before he records too much sensory data and begins to interpret it as law. It is also a good idea to read the works of colleagues who have done some testing and have recorded their observations. As far back as Plato, in the Republic, we find that some men were aware that things were not as they appeared to the senses. Here we find Plato describing man as being chained in a cave of shadows, reading the shadows as his only reality, when the true reality was the light outside the cave which created the shadows. Some of the most dynamic contributions to psychology were not made by psychologists. The latter were too busy packaging their questionable commodity. Uspensky has some worthy comments in the first chapter of his book, The Psychology of Man's Possible Evolution. Bertalanffy was the biologist, but he contributed more to psychological understanding than Freud. Of my readings, Jung stands alone as the sole psychologist with concern for the truth about the nature of man more than for the success of his practice. Van der Loo depicts with greater dexterity than any other writer the predicament of man in relation to his senses. Chilton Pierce has the courage to attack the universal paradigm. Paul Brunton writes of the encouragement by man of a realm of illusion in The Wisdom of the Overself. It is not difficult to see, first, that our senses are inadequate, and second, that we fall into the trap of collective acceptance of a belief status for things rather than a relentless personal investigation of measurements and checking systems for the senses. We need only to look at a hologram to realize that we cannot be sure of that which we think we see. Because of the concave surface of the retina and the convex surface of the iris of the eye, all incoming sights are inverted. However, somewhere here inside the mind or brain, the picture is adjusted once more, and we relate properly to the things which we encounter in the environment. Once we are aware of this ability of the mind to readjust images, we become aware of a process that occurs continually within the mind. And once we become aware of the processes of the mind involved in this instance, we have begun to examine the mind by observing processes brought to our attention by the scientific knowledge of lenses and the consequent human adaptation to the inversion. While science may help us in some mental realizations, science is not infallible in itself. A few years back, science announced with absolute and infallible error that the universe had been completely reduced to an exact and unchangeable number of elements, which was a figure less than 100. Chemistry has made many concessions since then and has added about 20 elements to its table. An item to take note of is that science does not explain all that it sees, nor does a scientist see all that he explains. Many explanations in the scientific fields are only concept structures. Kuhn, as quoted by Ornstein in The Psychology of Consciousness, testifies that science is only a paradigm created by agreement. In each century, the authorities of science and medicine had to reluctantly admit that the claims of their predecessors were false or insufficient. Yet the same authorities never hesitated to demand that we treat their hypotheses as law. With the discovery of oxygen, the phlogistic theory had to be renounced. Some mistakes are not renounced, they are just neglected and gradually forgotten. Science often makes a half-hearted attempt to explain many phenomena which appear to be beyond the pale of present scientific explanations. I am thinking particularly of instances such as levitation, psychokinesis, and unidentified celestial objects. Scientists would prefer to write all of these off as either hallucinations or deliberate trickery. Yet science would ask that we accept its subliminal explanation and only its version of things that pertain to a particular concept structure which it entertains. Science talks of viruses which it does not see, and conceives of an antimatter which would place in jeopardy its own previous concepts of the indestructibility of matter. It reduces the electron down to component force fields, and with this it boldly, if not unwittingly, places chemistry in the realm of metaphysics. And all of this is done without seeing this antimatter or this force field, even with the most modern microscope. My point is that if the materialist scientist can prove himself to be inadequate or inaccurate and not the possessor of a total knowledge of all things, then the infant science of psychology and its methodology, which pretends to be a science, is more excusable when it legislates with shamanistic fear, a fear of an exposure of its inadequacy to explain phenomena in its field. So that if you wish to be scientific about the examination of the self or mind of man, you must bear in mind that not all authoritative pronouncements on the matter are honest or radical. You have to check the source, and if the source is human, we must perhaps check his personal motivation for his findings. It may be profitable for him to ignore a problem if the solution will lessen his importance or prove him to have been previously in error. We are deluded by those in authority, and by this I mean that certain groups or professions are legally recognized as authorities on subjects, and these people bear the responsibility for maintaining tradition despite its ignorance or inadequacy. However, the law in itself is not scientific. It operates largely by precedence, and it endows titles and authority in a similar manner or sort of precedence. Only an authorized psychologist can teach psychology. If the authorized teacher is a fool or belongs to a particular fanatical school, then the scientific or truthful element in psychology may be lost. We are particularly deluded by the psychological scientist when he makes pronouncements about the mind without ever properly defining the mind and the nature of thought. We are further deluded by him in his failure to properly define the self, and for improperly implying the opposite, a non-self that must take testimony from another non-self, the reflex robot. Self-delusion. Many people wish to be deluded. Some wish to believe that they are a unique and eternal creature of limitless rights and individual potentials while they are in church. However, in a post-orgiastic funk, they will embrace any behavioristic doctrine that asserts the body is all that is important. If a person cannot free himself from self-delusion, there is no use trying to buck the system of authoritative ignorance. We delude ourselves about the identity of the self, and while we all admit being able to see, we know little about the process. By observing the process of seeing, we will learn more about he who is seeing, and will inevitably get into the machinery of self-delusion, and perhaps learn how to circumvent the machinery. Even before we know the true self properly, we can realize that we are deluded by our environment, and that we are capable of deluding ourselves. We talk ourselves into things which later we repudiate. We become victims of excesses and later denounce the convictions that led us into addiction. We project qualities upon people only to learn that we were grossly wrong in our projection. We adopt entire philosophies not because of an orientation toward the truth, but because of rationalization and the same motives manifested by animals or by men who will ultimately try to justify behavior similar to animals. When we talk of self-delusion, we cannot help notice that we have admitted a personal dichotomy and that one part of us is doing something, deluding, to another part. If you admit that you delude yourself, you immediately recognize that there is a part of self that is true or truth-oriented and another part that can deliberately or unwittingly delude the other part. We should note at this time that it is the truth-oriented part of the self that has the erroneous judgment. The errors are imposed upon it by a lesser or mundane self or by desires which may be only a fragmentary part of the mundane self or parts that may only be voices or appetites, yet they may be determining factors of lethal proportions. It is the observer that is the victim of the delusion. Delusions often have an adverse effect upon the body as well upon the mind, so that we have a self, self-particle or appetites that establish themselves as being extraneous to the observer, so that it is apparent that at times the inner self or interior observer is incapable of infallible apprehension, and even more, it is capable of distorted creations.